is Adam Klein, Global Graduate Director, faculty member at New Ventures West. This is episode 7 of our podcast, Stepping In, a podcast where we delve into how integral coaching can address some of the most pressing issues we face as individuals, as communities, and as stewards of our planet. In this episode, we pick up the study of systems again, this time looking at how we can be more effective in them by understanding the nature of the system itself. In this episode, I was joined by faculty member Julie Engel. Like all of our guests, there are so many things to say about Julie. She's a certified Hakomi therapist, has a PhD from Boston College, and is a student of the Diamond Approach. More about her and some of her writing on our website. Welcome, Julie. I'm really grateful that we're able to sit down and talk today.
Me too.
And I know in talking about, you know, this episode and kind of the theme of it, one of the things that we talked about is sort of a place to start, at least, was the idea of how we all live inside of complex systems. Mm-hmm. And in the living of that, in the living inside of them, that, you know, the way I would say it is there's a couple orientations we can have. One is to be like a victim of it, where we feel like everything is just happening to us and we try to resist mm-hmm. it as strong as we can so we're not pushed over by someone else's agenda. Mm-hmm. And then maybe another way of orienting around living in a complex system of acknowledging that this is what it is and how can I respond in a helpful way, in a creative way, sort of to create as much as possible the outcome that I'm looking to create in this. Mm-hmm. So I'd just love to hear you speak a little bit more about this and, you know, see where our conversation goes.
Yeah. So maybe I'm just thinking maybe I can start by talking a little bit about the character. When I say complex systems, what I'm referring to.
Yeah, that would be great.
And I can say, and this might be a great resource for people, is the person whose work I have looked to mostly for my current understanding of this is a guy named David Snowden, who has a consultancy called Cognitive Edge. But one of the things Snowden talks about is that there are different kind. You can make distinctions about different systems. And it's important because the way of functioning in response to each kind of system is quite different. So just to do a quick go around, one is would be the simplest is what he would call an obvious system. And in an obvious system, there is clear cause and effect. Like you do X and then Y happens. You know, you put the quarter in, I don't even know if you do this anymore, but used to put the quarter or the change into the soda machine and it would go clunk, 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 and a soda would come out if things were working well. And so you can understand the causes and effects. So that would be simple.
Before you move on to the second one, what strikes me is, so you use some like really, well, you know, simple examples to illustrate the simple system. And I know you're going to speak about a couple more, but how I think we can get caught in the trap of thinking of life as a simple system. Like the example that comes to my mind is like, oh, if I go to the right schools and do the right thing and get the right grades, then in a simple system, I'm going to get the right job. And
yeah,
turns out that's not always true.
Right. And we resent it. Or here's another one. I will never forget when Obama was doing a speech and he was trying to explain all of the forces at play that determine the price of gas. But mostly the way people respond is gas prices are higher, lower them, damn it.
Right.
That would be, there's a problem, fix it.
Exactly.
And right. That there is a clear and obvious way to fix it, that if we fix it, we'll cause the result we want and expect. And so when that doesn't happen, it can be frustrating and we can be resentful or even despairing, right?
Exactly.
And then I would say, if we're talking about, since the context for this is organizations, what David Snowden would say is there are very few things that actually in an organization ought to reside in the obvious domain and that there's a tendency to want to push things there. So the second kind of what he calls ordered system is what he calls a complicated system. And a complicated system is one in which there are clear causes and effects, but there are enough of them that you need to have some kind of expertise to understand them and to propose solutions. And that what he would say is that, just going back to obvious systems, in obvious systems, he talks about what he says, there is best practice. Like, if this happens, then you do that. In complicated systems, he says, we have good practice, which means there are enough causal factors at play that, depending on the context, there may be some range of solutions that are useful. And so, but the solutions are not necessarily obvious on the face of it. So here's an example for me, is that if I think about a car mechanic, that a car, an automobile, you could say is a closed system. And so I don't have the expertise. I know that my car brakes. I know that I hear certain sounds. I know that the light comes on the dashboard. And I bring it to the mechanic, who, thank God, knows all of the moving parts and how they work together, and can give me his or her best perspective on what I need to fix, including what do I really need to fix now and what can I wait a little bit about. So that would be for me, or, you know, it's like any domain where there's some expertise needed.
Yep.
So let me talk a little bit about complex systems.
Yeah.
So when David Soden talks about complex systems, what he's saying is both the obvious and complicated systems are what he calls ordered systems, meaning you can track causes and effects, even though they can get quite sophisticated. What he says is when you move into complex systems, you enter into disordered systems. And so what he says is that in disordered systems, there are two kinds of systems. One he will call complex and the other chaotic, and I'll talk about both. But let me start with complex. So complex is when there are so many factors at play that you can't really talk about causality, because it's so complex that you don't know how what's affecting what. And so it can be very frustrating when people want to solve a problem with the answer, because what's true about a system is the system is acting on itself all the time. It's never static. And so, you know, what you see, for instance, in organizations a lot is people are in a complex system. I do a lot of work in startups, which there's lots of moving parts all the time, which is true actually everywhere. But you can see people wanting it to, they're waiting for a respite. They're waiting for a moment when things slow down or where there's a greater sense of stability, because they're up against their threshold and having difficulty functioning in an environment that's always changing. So that their comments about what's happening often show up as complaints about how it is. And so in a complex system, what Snowden talks about is it's not about good practice or best practice. What you're doing is you need to, what he calls probe, you need to observe the system, experiment with affecting the system in some way, and then observing how the system responds.
Mm.
So it's a much more of an experimental approach.
Yep.
So in a complex system, it's this probe, see how the system responds, and then based on how the system responds, decide to continue or amplify what you're doing, or to pull it back or abandon it.
Yep.
And so, you know, for folks who are familiar with sort of the startup space in organizations, there's something called lean as a methodology. And one of the things about lean is it recognizes the complex nature of organizations and the nature of a startup, where in the lean approach, what you're doing is you're always testing your hypotheses. Your hypotheses about the market, your hypotheses about your product, your hypotheses about customers and how what's attractive to them, and about pricing. And you're doing tests so that you get a response, and you do enough testing so that you can begin to build. And then over time, as an organization scales, things start to become more routinized. Mm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Yeah. And I'm curious what you've noticed. I know there's the chaotic system, but while we're here, just one other question, and then we'll talk about chaotic, and I'm sure circle back. Well, what have you noticed about in your work with like startups or any other organization for that matter, mm-hmm. how introducing these distinctions, particularly the one of complicated to complex, how that affects people and what you invite people to. Yeah.
Right. So here's what I see, and I've seen this multiple times with clients in several startups that I work with. So I'm working with someone and their work and their discipline, like business operations, lives in mostly the complicated space. Like they're the person who historically in their profession and their career has instituted business processes, you know, analysis, reporting, those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And that this is a classic one. So that person who is sort of their comfort is in the complicated space is interacting with the founder who is in the complex space on steroids.
Right. Yes.
You know, they're like, okay, here's what we're going to do and let's see. And, you know, then they have their next big idea. And so this classic, I'm just thinking of this one client and the founder. Her mood was one of deep frustration. And she felt not respected, like she began to question her value. She began to feel like she wasn't seen. And she was actually taking it really personally. And when I introduced her to these distinctions, she could see, oh, I get it. So in organizations, there's all of these. And my discipline lives here. So the frustration I'm feeling, sure, I could take it personally, but it's really got to do with this clash of people who are living in these different spaces. Mm. And so it helped her in coaching language. She became a different kind of observer. It was a distinction that allowed her to understand what was happening so that when she felt it personally, she actually could begin to remind herself that it actually wasn't personal. Right. Or at least not so personal, because she had a lot of pride in her work and in her profession, you know?
Yeah.
But that's the thing I see, is it seems to have the effect of creating some space for people to be able to see what's happening and to not get so blended with what's going on in a personal way that inhibits them.
Yeah. Well, and I think this is a powerful distinction in this specific context. And I also think it speaks to the power of, like, when you invite a distinction that really lands in a client's world, the power that it can mm-hmm. have, giving them
exactly.
just that much distance to where they can observe a little bit differently and, you know, have an effect on their mood, how they're relating to what's happening. And it can be really
exactly.
Strong. Yeah.
Right. I think that's part of what I see, is it helps making these distinctions seems to help people begin to meet the world as it is rather than as they wish it was.
Yes, exactly what I was just thinking. Speaking to this longing they have that eventually we will get there. And this is a way of saying, well, actually, no, this is the way that it is and will continue to be. It's the nature of things.
The other thing about complex systems is recognizing that you don't have control.
That's big.
You know, that you don't have control over how different factors interact. They interact the way they interact, and you get to respond.
Right. Yeah, you see the results of the interaction and then can respond based on that. You can't predictively respond because you don't know.
Right, right. But you can see over time if certain patterns emerge, and that's when it begins to move into that complicated space. Then you can begin to sort of create structure, because there's enough of a reliable pattern to things, at least for now.
Right, right. So what what else happens for people as you introduce these distinctions in terms of responses that you've seen, dips in mood? I'm just curious. What else you've noticed there?
Right. Well, for some people, it's like, really? It's like, oh, man, I don't like it, right? But then you can have a very grown-up conversation about, okay, I get you don't like it, and this is, at least in your organization, sort of the way it is. So, you know, where are you about sort of approaching the way it is or recognizing this is just not the context you want to be in.
Yeah.
So there's that. Other people are, some people, by the way, there are people who love this.
Mm.
I mean, they live and thrive in the complex space.
Right.
So this is not, it's not the case for everybody that it's like, it's fraught. It's not. Some people, like I would say, this founder, there are other people who are really quite creative. And indeed, as things become complicated, they start to feel constrained.
Yeah.
Because that's actually one of the dynamics that would happen between my client and the founder. She would start to introduce structure and he would start to feel constrained. And that's when she would start to feel pushed out, So, there are people who there are people who prefer their preferences, the complexity space, and they're very creative and thrive on experimentation. And then when things can be routinized or structured or made into a process, they're no longer, it loses interest for them because they thrive on the dynamism.
Yeah. I raised my hand for that system, the preference being for the complex and
right.
And the recognition of the multiple systems and appreciating the complicated and having things move to complicated and then the freedom that can come from that structure, even as complicated as it is. So how these things live harmoniously with each other and to see that is such a beautiful thing. And then to see how we all have our preferences. Yes. And
so exactly.
And you can also, work on your skills. But then the beautiful part of working on teams where we don't all have to have the same preferences to make things work.
Right, exactly. What you were saying for me about how these work together in an integral way is important because I think about my own coaching practice and I think the part that I thrive on is put me in a room with a client or put me in front of the room and I'm fearless about whatever shows itself, I'm with it.
Right.
I'm not trying to give my client a solution or a whatever. I'm up for whatever's emerging and responding to that. And certainly, like seeing clients in startups, I see certain patterns. But my weaker point is in the space of the complicated around structure and, back end structures that can be in the complicated space around invoicing and scheduling and reporting and those kinds of things.
Yeah.
And I'm grateful to the people who assist me who have skill and a preference for those kinds, that space. Because it's exactly what you said. It frees me up to be able to do the work that is most compelling for me. But I ignore the back end at my own peril.
Exactly. Right.
It's like the cash flow doesn't happen unless the invoices go out.
Yes. Right? Yes. This is all connected here.
Right. So maybe I should talk a little bit about the chaotic.
Yeah.
It's easier. That's a sort of a quicker one, which is so chaotic is something happens and you don't know what kind of system you're in. So an example would be, 9/11 or anytime there's a terrorist attack or a big storm, something happens and everything is upset or chaotic and you don't know what kind of system you're in. And in that kind of system, the appropriate action is take an action.
Mm.
Because once you take an action, that then lets you know what kind of system you're in. And then it then flips into one of the other ones.
Yeah. Yeah. It feels like in the chaotic, we're back to just go with whatever instinctually occurs to you, do that, see what happens and then respond again.
Right. And the thing is intervene.
Right? Yeah. Right.
So it's, what you said before about we have preferences, that's actually one of Snowden's, he points to that as a concern that managers and leaders have places they prefer to function and that has implications for how they respond and that their response may not be the most appropriate if they can only respond in the space that's their preference.
Yeah. Well, because it keeps what I'm hearing is it keeps the breakdown cycling.
So, so here's what I notice. For many people, and I think this is true for many coaches in terms of clients, But I have a lot of people who come to me, and my assessment is they're somewhere in balance or early to traversing conversations.
As a side note for our listeners, what she's speaking about are, this is the 10 ways, which is a developmental model used in integral.
Oh, great. And so I work with people often along two general dimensions, and it looks different depending on what the presenting issue is for them, and them, you know, as a person. But I work both with how they relate to themselves and with how they relate to the system. And so one of the things I find is that for many people living and working in a complex system, they feel like they're one of those silver balls inside of a pinball machine.
Yes.
You know, the flappers, they kind of yep. flap the ball. You know? And then it's sort of like, you know, and so the executive team pulls that thing that you pull that sets the balls in motion. You know? Although some of the executives feel that way too, right?
Right. Depending on who the investors are, who the board is, sure.
So I almost always at some point make these distinctions about what's the reality within which they're living. And then what I find is that for many people, going back to what you said earlier at the very beginning about how do you cultivate your capacity to not feel like you're at the whim or the victim of this kind of environment.
Yeah.
And so a lot of what I find myself doing is there's some education and then practices. So the education is about how do nervous systems work? You know, how does the nervous system work when it feels like there's a threat? How does the nervous system work when it meets a threshold for what it needs for stability? And so part of what I like to do, and I draw on the work of Daniel Siegel and the work of David Rock for this, is having people see that the nervous system, their nervous system is the kind of nervous system that mammals have.
Yes.
And so a lot of how they find themselves triggered, on the one hand, yes, it's personal. On the other hand, it's the way human nervous systems work.
Yep.
That when we perceive a threat, and the perception of threat happens unconsciously. It's not like we see something and we say, oh, that's a threat. The nervous system reacts to something, and then we sort of catch up to whatever it is by being able to name it.
Right.
So part of what I try to do with people is make some distinctions around that, so that what they can begin to do is to begin to see that some of what feels quite personal for them, and they might be making themselves wrong for, like, I shouldn't react so strongly, or I shouldn't get so flustered. For many people, it's like, well, but wait, your nervous system is doing what a human nervous system does.
That's right.
Under threat. And here, because David Rock's SCARF model is a great, easily accessible piece for people. These are the different kinds of issues where people have thresholds. And when they pass that threshold, their nervous system goes into fight or flight. Basically, the higher functions of our brain aren't accessible to us in the same way. And so when people can begin, people making this distinction with people about the way the human brain and nervous system works, that nervous systems react. And so for them to see, oh, what's happening for me is what happens to a mammal in these kinds of situations. Oh, okay. So a little bit of space for compassion. And then what we begin to do, and again, different for different people, what are the practices that they can begin to engage in that would help them cultivate a nervous system that I call it increasing. I draw this from the work of Pat Ogden and also Daniel Siegel, to expand their window of tolerance, meaning expand their comfort zone so that they don't get so triggered so quickly. And that is not part of what I think is important is that is not a function of will. That's a function of training your nervous system.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, there's this great quote a colleague of mine, Jen Cohen, shared with me from Bruce Lee, which says, under stress, we fall to the level of our training. A lot, for me, a big part of my context is, how can we train ourselves to have a nervous system that is durable and grounded so that we can tolerate and respond well in environments that are pretty unstable?
Yeah.
What I find is that, you know, and so there are practices around learning to work with your nervous system. You know, whether it's, you know, body sensing or grounding or, you know, there's a whole host of things they can do.
I'm just going to press you for like one specific grounding exercise that you've recommended, and maybe for people who are listening so that maybe they have something to try themselves.
Right. So for instance, for me, when I'm coaching, I always look at, I have two kinds of practices. I call them on the mat and off the mat. So on the mat practices are practices that you can begin to do in the midst of a situation. So, and it takes some ability to self-observe to do that. So it might be you're in a meeting and you've begun to see, you can feel your body getting triggered. And so then a grounding practice would be, okay, feel your feet and take a few breaths. And nobody needs to know you're doing that. That's on the mat.
Right.
You know, another on the mat practice would be, as you, you know, when you get an email from someone, when they can see, again, this requires them to begin to see they're triggered, or they can actually do this without being triggered. So, you know, when you're crafting a response, before you press send, take a moment and breathe to actually pause and then reread the email, imagining you're the person on the receiving end. And what's the impact? You know, what impact do you imagine? So it's helping them move into a more reflective space. Or, so those are kind of on the mat.
Yep.
Or a practice when people are beginning a meeting. You know, people in meetings, for many, you know, meetings for most people are an opportunity to not get work done. I mean, they were, I should not an opportunity, but it's they complain about them because they don't think work gets done in most meetings, right?
Right.
There's sort of talk happens and then you go back to work. In fact, meetings get in the way of work. And so a practice that I've given many, many clients is, as you're beginning a meeting, don't just state the agenda, share with the group, here's our intended outcomes for this meeting, or here's what I'd like us to accomplish, or here's what I'd like you to, you know, what I'd like to have happen by the end of this meeting. So that you're not just telling people what we're going to talk about, the agenda becomes the vehicle for accomplishing the outcomes.
Right.
And so it has the effect of creating a sense of, you know, again, it's a sense of intentionality versus just talking. So those are all on the mat practices that you're practicing in the middle of the action. But then there are these other practices that I call off the mat. And I know Richard Heckler has a name for them. I forget what he calls them, but they're sort of foundational practices. And I talk about them as, you know, the way astronauts train and train and train and train and do simulation after simulation. So that when a range of situations arise, they're able to respond. Because they've been practicing, it's in their body versus reacting.
Right.
And that they can even be generative, meaning it's not simply responding, it's something new can emerge, right? And so, you know, there are practices I ask people to engage in, whether it's some sort of contemplative practice or, you know, one I just recently have asked a client to sing in their car because it has to do with them cultivating a more robust voice so that they can intervene with more power. But it's practicing and practicing and practicing so that when they arrive in the situation, they're more likely to have access to whatever that competence or quality is.
Beautiful.
So I have another, this is a great quote from the Dalai Lama that I have on my desktop. Dalai Lama says, a tree with strong roots can withstand the most violent storm, but the tree can't grow roots just as the storm appears on the horizon. I love that, right?
That's beautiful. Yeah, it's fantastic.
And so for me, that's the distinction of, you know, what I call off the mat. It's cultivating the embodied capacity.
Yeah.
So that when we meet the circumstances, we have more access to that capacity.
Yep. And as you work with people in these on the mat or off the mat practices, working with your clients, what are you noticing over time?
So what I hear is some variation of, they have more capacity to stay grounded as the circumstances do what they do. It's almost like, rather than, you know, those, little, they're toy like punching bags that have sand on the bottom,
mm-hmm.
and you punch them and then they bounce back.
Yep.
That's more what they feel like, is that they may get thrown, but they bounce back.
Mm.
It's like they don't get knocked off their feet.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And the other piece that I see, and that they don't necessarily always come up with this word, but it's present for me and I'll say it and they'll go, oh yeah, is they are able to maintain a sense of their dignity.
Ah.
You know, that they have a sense of being able to sort of be present so that they can respond with dignity in the way that they really want to versus reacting.
Yeah. Wow. That sounds really powerful. Like coming from themselves rather than just from this instinctual response.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And so it's, yeah, so it is. It's, there's something for me really beautiful seeing that unfold for people, is that they get that capacity about themselves. And it is certainly something that takes time to develop that, but you can see it when they, you know, they come back each, you know, every other week when I see them and they begin to talk about how they're responding. You can begin to see, and they begin to see, that was different.
Oh, yeah. That sounds fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, we've covered quite a bit. Anything else you want to say in closing?
Yeah. Here's what I would say, is that I feel like, while I'm talking about this in the context of clients I work with in organizations, for me, this, what I'm talking about is true about life in general.
Yep.
And that I will say for myself that I am grateful for the practices that I engage in, because I can see over the, you know, the years that I've engaged in practices like this in a steady way, that something does shift in one's nervous system. And so for me, that's hopeful. I think the other thing is that I feel like having the perspective that I just shared can introduce a sense of self-compassion for people.
Yep.
And I think that's so important, is that, you know, we do live in a pretty nutty world, and we really are doing the best that we can given whatever our current capacity is for each of us, even though some of it looks pretty damn weird.
Right.
But, you know, if we can sort of see that we are human beings, and human beings, you know, our systems tend to function in a certain way, and that we can have some compassion and then, you know, maybe dedicate ourselves to working with ourselves so that we can live with the kind of dignity we yearn for.
This is Adam Klein, Global Graduate Director and faculty member at New Ventures West, and I've been joined by special guest Julie Engel. This has been another episode of the podcast Stepping In. Please spread the news by sharing this podcast on social media, and let us know what you think by emailing us at steppingin@newventureswest.com. Until next time, take care.